Really think Braud was used by her totem to test her? Braud looked uncomfortable. I thought when the lynx attacked me, it was a test too. I almost stopped hunting after that. I was too afraid. Then I got the idea to try two stones, so I would have something to try again if I missed the first time. I even thought my totem gave me the idea.
I see, the holy man said. I'd like some time to meditate on this, Brunn. Maybe we should all think about it. We'll meet again tomorrow morning, he announced, without the girl. What is there to think about? Braud objected. We all know the punishment she deserves. Her punishment could be dangerous to the whole clan, Braud. I need to be absolutely sure there isn't something we've overlooked before I condemn her. We will meet again tomorrow.
As the men returned to the cave, they talked among themselves. I never knew of a woman who wanted to hunt, Thrug said.
Could it have something to do with her totem? It's a male totem. I didn't want to question Mogur's judgment at the time, Saug said. But I always did wonder about her cave lion, even with the marks on her leg. I don't doubt it any more. He was right. He always is.
Could she be part male? Krug commented. There's been some talk.
That would account for her unwomanly ways, Dorv added. She's female, all right. There's no doubt of that, Braud said. She must be killed. Everyone knows it.
You're probably right, Braud, Krug said.
Even if she is part male, I don't like the idea of a woman hunting, Dorv commented dourly. I don't even like her being part of the clan. She's too different.
You know I've always felt that way, Dorv, Braud agreed. I don't know why Brunn wants to talk about it again.
If I were leader, I'd just do it and be done with it.
It's not a decision to make lightly, Braud, Braud said.
What's your hurry? One more day won't matter.
Braud hurried ahead without bothering to respond. That old man is always lecturing, he thought, always sticking up for Brunn. Why can't Brunn make a decision? I've made up my mind. What good is all this talk? Maybe he's getting old, too old to lead anymore.
Ayla stumbled back after the men. She went straight to the cave to Kreb's hearth and sat on her sleeping fur, staring into space. Issa tried to coax her to eat, but she just shook her head. Uba wasn't sure what was going on, but something was troubling the tall, wonderful girl, the special friend she loved and idolized. She went to Ayla and crawled into her lap. Ayla held the small girl, silently rocking her. Somehow Uba knew she was a comfort. She didn't squirm to get down. She just allowed herself to be held and rocked, and finally fell asleep. Issa took the child from Ayla's arms and put her to bed, then retired to her own. But she didn't sleep. Her heart was too full of grief for the strange girl she called daughter, who sat staring at the glowing coals of the cooling fire. The morning dawned clear and cold. Ice was forming on the edges of the stream, and a thin film of solidified water covered the still, spring-fed pond near the mouth of the cave in the mornings, usually melted by the time the sun was high. Before very much longer, the clan would be confined to the cave for the winter. Issa didn't know if Ayla had slept. She was still sitting on her fur when the woman awoke. The girl was silent, lost in a world of her own, hardly conscious of her own thoughts. She just waited. Kreb did not return to his hearth for the second night. Issa saw him shuffle into the dark crevice that was the entrance to his inner sanctum. He didn't come out again until morning. After the men left, Issa brought the girl some tea, but Ayla didn't respond to the medicine woman's gentle questions. When she returned, the tea was still beside the girl, cold and untouched. It's as though she's already dead, Issa thought. Her breath caught in her throat as the icy claw of sorrow gripped her heart. It was almost more than Issa could bear. Brunn led the men to a place in the lee of a large boulder, sheltered from the brisk wind, and had a fire built before he opened the meeting. The discomfort of sitting in the cold might encourage the men to be hasty, and he wanted to know the full range of their feelings and opinions. When he began, it was in the completely silent symbols used to address spirits, and it told the men this was not a casual gathering, but a formal meeting.
The girl Ayla, a member of our clan, used a sling to kill the hyena that attacked Brock. For 3 years she has used the weapon. Ayla is female. By clan tradition, a female who uses a weapon must die. Does anyone have anything they want to say?
Thrug would speak, Brunn.
Thrug may speak, When the medicine woman found the girl, we were looking for a new cave. The spirits were angry with us and sent an earthquake to destroy our home. Maybe they weren't so angry. Maybe they just wanted a better place. And maybe they wanted us to find the girl. She is strange, unusual, like a sign from a totem. We have been lucky since we found her. I think she brings luck, and I think it comes from her totem. It's only part of her strangeness that she was chosen by the great cave lion. We thought she was peculiar because she liked to go into the water of the sea. But if she had not been so peculiar, Ona would be walking the spirit world now. Ona is only a girl and not even born to my hearth, but I have grown to love her. I would have missed her. I'm grateful she didn't drown. She is strange to us, but we know little of the others. She is clan now, but she was not born clan. I don't know why she ever wanted to hunt. It's wrong for clan women to hunt, but maybe their women do. It doesn't matter. It was still wrong. But if she hadn't taught herself to use a sling, Brock would be dead too. It's not pleasant to think of the way he would have died. For a hunter to be killed by a meat-eater is one thing, but Brock is a baby. His death would have been a loss to the whole clan, Brunn, not just to Braud and you. If he had died, we wouldn't be sitting here trying to decide what to do about the girl who saved his life. We'd be grieving for the boy who will one day be leader. I think the girl should be punished, but how can she be condemned to die? I am finished. Zaug would speak, Brunn. Zaug may speak. What Drug says is true. How can you condemn the girl when she saved Brock's life? She is different. She wasn't born clan, and maybe she doesn't think like a woman should. But except for the matter of the sling, she behaves like a good clan woman. She has been a model woman, obedient, respectful. That's not true. She's rebellious, insolent, Braud interrupted. I am speaking now, Braud, Zaug returned angrily. Brunn shot him a disapproving glance, and Braud curbed his outburst. It's true, Zaug continued. When the girl was younger, she was insolent to you, Braud. But you brought it on yourself. You're the one who let it bother you. If you act like a child, is it so strange that the girl does not treat you like a man? She has never been anything but dutiful and obedient to me. Nor has she ever been insolent to any other man. Braud glowered at the old hunter, but held himself in check. Even if it were not true, Zaug continued, I have never seen anyone as good with a sling as she is. She says she learned from me. I never knew it, but I will say openly, I wish I had so apt a pupil to teach. And I must admit, I could learn from her now. She wanted to hunt for the clan, and when she couldn't, she tried to find another way to help the clan. She may have been born to the others, but in her heart she is clan. She has always put the interests of the clan before herself. She didn't think of the danger when she went after Ona. She may be able to move on the water, but I saw how tired she was when she brought Ona back. The sea could have taken her, too. She knew it was wrong for her to hunt, kept her secret hidden for 3 years, but she didn't hesitate when Brock's life was in danger. She is skilled with that weapon, more skilled than anyone I've ever seen. It would be a shame to let that skill go to waste. I say, let her be a benefit to the clan. Let her hunt. No, no, no! Braud jumped up in anger. She is female. Females cannot be allowed to hunt. Braud, the proud old hunter said, I am not through. You may ask to speak when I am done. Let Zaug finish, Braud, the leader cautioned. If you do not know how to conduct yourself at a formal meeting, you may leave. Braud sat down again, struggling to control himself. The sling is not an important weapon. I only began to develop my skill after I got too old to hunt with a spear. It's the other weapons that are the real men's weapons. I say, let her hunt, but only with a sling. Let the sling be the weapon of old men and women, or at least this one. I am finished now. Zaug, you know as well as I that it is more difficult to use a sling than a spear. And many times you have provided meat when the hunt was a failure. Don't belittle yourself for the girl's sake. With a spear, you only need a strong arm, Brunn said, and strong legs, and heart, and good lungs, and a great deal of courage, Zaug replied. I wonder how much courage it took to face another lynx after being attacked by one alone with only a sling, Drug commented. I wouldn't object to Zaug's suggestion if she hunts only with a sling. The spirits don't seem to object. She is still bringing us luck. What about our mammoth hunt?
I'm not sure that's a decision we can make, Brunn said. I don't see any way we can even allow her to live, much less hunt.
You know the tradition, Zaug. It's never been done before. Would the spirits really approve? What made you think of it anyway? Clan women don't hunt.
Yes, clan women don't hunt. But this one has. I probably wouldn't have thought of it if I didn't know she could, if I hadn't already seen her. All I'm saying is, let her continue to do what she has already done.
What do you say, Mogur? Brune asked.
What do you expect him to say? She lives at his hearth,
Braud interjected bitterly.
Braud, Brune stormed. Are you accusing Mogur of putting his own feelings, his own interests, before those of the clan? Is he not Mogur? The Mogur? You think he will not say what is right, what is true?
No, Brune. Braud has made a good point. My feelings for Ayla are well known. It's not easy to forget I love her. I think you should all remember that, even though I've tried to put emotions aside. I can't be sure that I have. I've been fasting and meditating since you returned, Brunn. Last night I found my way to memories I never knew, perhaps because I never looked. Long ago, long before we were clan, women helped men to hunt.
There was a gasp of disbelief.
It's true. We will have a ceremony, and I will take you there. When we were first learning to make tools and weapons, and we were born with a knowing that was like memories, but different. Women and men both killed animals for food. Men did not always provide for women then. Like a mother bear, a woman hunted for herself and her children. It was later that men began to hunt for a woman and her young, and even later, before women with children stayed behind. When men began to care about the young, when they began to provide, it was the beginnings of the clan and helped it to grow. If a mother of a young child died while she was trying to get food, the baby died too. But it wasn't until people stopped fighting each other and learned to cooperate, to hunt together, that the clan really began. Even then, some women hunted, when they were the ones who talked to the spirits. Brunn, you said it's never been done before. You are wrong. Clan women have hunted before. The spirits approved then, but they were different spirits. Ancient spirits, not the spirits of totems. They were powerful spirits, but they have long since gone to rest. I'm not sure if they can rightfully be called clan spirits. It wasn't that they were honored or venerated, more that they were feared. But they weren't evil, just powerful.
The men were stunned. He spoke of times so ancient and so little recalled, they were almost forgotten, almost new. Yet just his mentioning of them evoked a recollection of the fear, and more than one man shuddered.
I doubt that women born to the clan now would ever want to hunt, Mogur continued. I'm not sure they could. It's been too long. Women have changed since then. So have men. But Ayla is different. The others are different, more different than we think. I don't think letting her hunt would make any difference as far as the other women are concerned. Her hunting, her wanting to hunt, surprises them as much as us.
I have nothing more to say.
Does anyone have anything more to say? Brunn asked.
He wasn't sure, though, that he was ready for more. Too many new ideas had already been proposed for comfort.
Guv would speak, Brunn.
Guv may speak.
I am only an acolyte. I don't know as much as Mogur, but I think he overlooked something. Maybe it's because he has tried so hard to put aside his feeling for Ayla. He has concentrated on remembering, not on the girl herself. Perhaps out of fear it would be his love speaking and not his mind. He hasn't thought about her totem. Has anyone considered why a powerful male totem would choose a girl? He answered his own rhetorical question. Except for Ursus, the cave lion is the most powerful totem. The cave lion is more powerful than the mammoth. He hunts mammoth. Only the young and old, but he does hunt mammoth sometimes. The cave lion does not hunt mammoth.
You're not making sense, Guv. You say the cave lion hunts mammoth, then you say he doesn't, Brunn gestured.
He doesn't, she does. We overlook that when we speak of protective totems. Even the male cave lion is the protector.
But who is the hunter? The largest meat-eater of all, the strongest hunter, is the lioness, the female. Is it not true she brings her kill to her mate? He can kill, but his job is to protect while she hunts. It's curious that a cave lion would choose a girl, isn't it? Has anyone ever thought that perhaps her totem is not the cave lion, but the cave lioness, the female, the hunter? Couldn't that explain why the girl wanted to hunt, why she was given a sign? Maybe it was the lioness who gave her the sign. Maybe that's why she was marked on her left leg. Is it really more exceptional for her to hunt than it is for her to have such a totem? I don't know if it's true, but you must admit it's reasonable. Whether her totem is cave lion or cave lioness, if she was meant to hunt, can we deny it? Can we deny her powerful totem? And do we dare condemn her for doing what her totem wishes? Goof concluded. I am finished. Brun's head was whirling. Ideas were coming at him too fast. He needed time to think, to work it out. Of course it's the lioness who hunts, but who ever heard of a female totem? The spirits, the essences of protective spirits are all male, aren't they? Only someone who spends long days dwelling on the ways of the spirits would come to the conclusion that the totem of the girl who had been hunting was the hunter of the species that embodied her totem. But Brun wished Goove hadn't brought up the idea of denying the wishes of so powerful a totem. The whole concept of a woman hunting was so unique, so thought-provoking, that several of the men had been jarred into making the small, incremental step that pushed the frontiers of their comfortable, secure, well-defined world. Each man spoke from his own viewpoint, from his own area of concern or interest, and each had pushed forward the frontier only in that one small area. But Brun had to embrace them all, and it was almost too much. He felt duty-bound to consider every aspect before he made a judgment, and he wished he had time to mull them over carefully. But a decision could not be held off much longer. Does anyone else have any more opinions? Braud would speak, Brun. Braud may speak. All these ideas are interesting and may give us something to think about on cold winter days, but the traditions of the clan are clear. Born to the others or not, the girl is clan. Clan females may not hunt. They may not even touch a weapon or any tool that is used to make a weapon. We all know the punishment. She must die. It makes no difference if long ago women once hunted. Because a she-bear hunts or a lioness doesn't mean a woman may. We are neither bears nor lions. It makes no difference if she has a powerful totem or if she brings luck to the clan. It makes no difference if she is good with a sling or even that she saved the life of the son of my mate. I am grateful for that, of course. Everyone has noticed I said so many times on the way back, I'm sure. But it makes no difference. The traditions of the clan make no allowances. A woman who uses a weapon must die. We cannot change that. It is the way of the clan. This whole meeting is a waste of time. There is no other decision you can make, Brun. I am finished. Braud is right, Dorf said. It is not our place to change the traditions of the clan. One exception leads to another. Soon there would be nothing we can count on. The punishment is death. The girl must die. There were a couple of nods of agreement. Brun did not respond immediately. Braud is right, he thought. What other decision can I make? She saved Brock's life, but she used a weapon to do it. Brun wasn't any closer to a resolution than he was the day Ayla pulled out her sling and killed the hyena. I will take all your thoughts into consideration before I make my decision. But now I want to ask each of you to give me a definite answer, the leader finally said. The men were sitting in a circle around the fire. They each clenched a fist and held it in front of their chests. A movement up and down would mean an affirmative answer. A lateral movement of the fist, no. Grad, Brun began with his second in command. Do you think the girl Ayla should die? Grad hesitated. He sympathized with the leader's dilemma. He had been Brun's second for many years. He could almost read the leader's thoughts, and his respect for him had grown with time. But he could see no alternative. He moved his fist up, then down. What other choice is there, Brun? He added. Grad says yes. Drug? Brun asked, turning to the toolmaker. Drug did not hesitate. He moved his fist across his chest. Drug says no. Drug, how about you?
Krug looked at Brunn, then Mogur, and finally Braud. He moved his fist up.
Krug says yes, the girl should die, Brunn confirmed. Guv?
The young acolyte responded immediately by drawing his fist across his chest.
Guv's opinion is no. Braud?
Braud moved his fist up before Brunn could say his name, and Brunn moved on just as quickly. He knew Braud's answer.
Yes. Zaug?
The old slingmaster sat up proudly and moved his fist back and forth across his chest with an emphasis that left no doubt.
Zaug thinks the girl should not die. What do you think, Dorv?
The hand of the other old man went up, and before he could bring it down, all eyes turned toward Mogur.
Dorv says yes. Mogur? What is your opinion?
Brunn asked. He had guessed what the others would say, but the leader wasn't sure about the old magician. Kreb agonized. He knew the clan traditions. He blamed himself for Ayla's crime, for giving her too much freedom. He felt guilty about his love for her, afraid it would usurp his reason, afraid he would think of himself before his duty to his clan, and began to move his fist up. Logically, he decided she must die. But before he could start the movement, his fist jerked to the side as though someone had grabbed it and moved it for him. He could not bring himself to condemn her, though he would do what he must once the decision was made. He had no choice. The choice was Brunn's, and only Brunn's.
The opinions are evenly divided, the leader announced. The decision was never anything but mine anyway. I only wanted to know how you felt. I will need some time to think about what was said today. Mogur says we will have a ceremony tonight. That's good. I will need the help of the spirits. And we all may need their protection. You will know my decision in the morning. She will know then, too. Go now, and prepare for the ceremony.
Brunn remained by the fire alone after the men left. Clouds scudded across the sky, driven by brisk winds, and dropped intermittent icy showers as they passed. But Brunn was as oblivious to the rain as he was to the last dying embers sputtering in the fireplace. It was nearing dark when he finally hauled himself up and plodded slowly back to the cave. He saw Ayla still sitting where he had seen her when they left in the morning. She expects the worst, he said to himself. What else can she expect? Chapter 16. The clan gathered outside the cave early. A chill east wind was blowing, hinting of icier blasts, but the sky was clear, and the morning sun just above the ridge, bright, in contrast to the somber mood. They avoided each other's eyes, arms hung limp with the absence of conversation, as they shuffled to their places to learn the fate of the strange girl who was no stranger to them. Uba could feel her mother shaking, and her hand gripped so hard it hurt. The child knew it was more than the wind that made her mother shiver so hard. Kreb was standing at the mouth of the cave. Never had the great magician seemed more forbidding. His ravaged face set in chiseled granite, his single eye opaque as stone. At a signal from Brunn, he limped into the cave, slowly, wearily, weighted by an overwhelming burden. He walked into his hearth and looked at the girl sitting on her fur, and with a supreme effort of will, forced himself to approach her.
Ayla, he said gently.
The girl looked up.
It's time. You must come now.
Her eyes were dull, uncomprehending.
You must come now, Ayla. Brunn is ready, Kreb repeated.
Ayla nodded and dragged herself up. Her legs were stiff from sitting so long. She hardly noticed. She followed dumbly behind the old man, staring at the trampled dust still bearing traces of those who had walked that way before. A heel mark, the imprint of toes, the blurred outline of a foot encased in a loose leather pouch, the round butt of Kreb's staff, and the furrow of his dragging lame leg. She stopped when she saw Brunn's feet, wrapped in their dusty coverings, and dropped to the ground. At a light tap on her shoulder, she forced herself to look up into the clan leader's face. The impact jolted her to awareness and awakened an undefinable fear. It was familiar. Low, swept-back forehead, heavy brows, large beaky nose, grizzled beard. But the proud, stern, hard look in the leader's eyes was gone, replaced by sincere compassion and luminous sorrow.
Ayla,
he said aloud, then continued with the formal gestures reserved for serious occasions.
Girl of the clan, the traditions are ancient. We have lived by them for generations, almost as long as the clan has existed. You were not born to us, but you are one of us, and you must live or die by those same customs. While we were north hunting mammoth, you were seen using a sling, and you have hunted with a sling before. Clan females may not use weapons. That is one of our traditions. The punishment, too, is part of the traditions. It is the clan way. It may not be changed. Brunn leaned forward and looked into the frightened blue eyes of the girl. I know why you used the sling, Ayla, though I still can't understand why you ever started. Brock would not be alive if it hadn't been for you. He straightened, and with the most formal of gestures made so everyone could see, he added, The leader of this clan is grateful to the girl for saving the life of the son of the mate of the son of my mate. A few glances passed among the watching clan. It was a rare concession for a man to make publicly, and more rare for a leader to admit gratitude to a mere girl. But the traditions make no allowances, he continued. He made a signal to Mogur, and the magician entered the cave. I have no choice, Ayla. Mogur is now setting the bones, and speaking aloud the names of those who are unmentionable, names known only to Mogur's. When he is through, you will die. Ayla, girl of the clan, you are cursed. Cursed with death. Ayla felt the blood drain from her face. Issa screamed and sustained it in a high-pitched wail, keening for her lost child. The sound was abruptly cut off as Brunn held up his hand. I am not finished, he motioned. In the sudden silence, glances of expectant curiosity passed quickly among the clan. What else could Brunn have to say? The traditions of the clan are clear, and as leader, I must follow the customs. A female who uses a weapon must be cursed with death. But there are no customs that say for how long. Ayla, you are cursed with death for one whole moon. If, by the grace of the spirits, you are able to return from the other world after the moon has gone through its cycle once and is in the same phase as now, you may live with us again. Commotion stirred the group. It was unexpected. That's true, Zaug motioned. Nothing says the curse must be permanent. But what difference does it make? How can someone be dead for so long and live again? A few days, maybe, but a whole moon? Drew questioned. If the curse was only for a few days, I'm not sure it would fulfill the punishment, Goof said. Some Mogurs believe the spirit never goes to the next world if the curse is short. It just hovers around waiting for the time to pass so it can come back if it's able. If the spirit stays near, the evil ones will too.
This is the end of disc number 9. Please insert disc number 10. This is disc number 10.
Goof said, Some Mogurs believe the spirit never goes to the next world if the curse is short. It just hovers around waiting for the time to pass so it can come back if it's able. If the spirit stays near, the evil ones will too. It's a limited death curse, but it's so long, it might as well be permanent. It satisfies the customs.
Then why didn't he just curse her and be done? Braud motioned angrily. There's nothing in the traditions about temporary death curses for her crime. She's supposed to die for it. The death curse is supposed to be the end of her.
You think it won't be, Braud? Do you really think she might come back? Goof asked.
I don't think anything. I just want to know why Brunn didn't just curse her. Can't he make a simple decision anymore?
Braud was flustered by the pointed question. It brought out in the open the idea everyone had privately wondered. Would Brunn impose a temporary death curse if he didn't think there was some chance, no matter how remote, that she might return from the dead? Brunn had wrestled with his dilemma the whole night. Ayla had saved the baby's life. It wasn't right that she should die for it. He loved the child, and he was sincerely grateful to her.
But there was more to it than his personal feelings. The traditions demanded her death. But there were other customs, too. Customs of obligation. Customs that said, a life for a life. She carried part of Brock's spirit. She deserved, she was owed, something of equal value. She was owed her life. Only with the first faint light of dawn had he finally thought of a way. Some hardy souls had returned after a temporary death curse. It was a long chance, almost no chance at all, just the barest glimmer of hope. In return for the life of the child, he gave her the one slim chance he could. It wasn't enough, but he could offer no more, and it was better than nothing at all. Suddenly, a deadly silence fell. Mogur was standing at the mouth of the cave, and he looked like death himself, ancient and drawn. There was no need for him to signal. It was done. Mogur had fulfilled his duty. Ayla was dead. Issa's wail pierced the air. Then Olga began, and Abra. Then all the women joined Issa, keening in sympathy with her. Ayla saw the woman she loved overwrought with grief and ran to her to comfort her. But just as she was about to throw her arms around the only mother she could remember, Issa turned her back and moved away to avoid the embrace. It was as though she didn't see her. The girl was confused. She looked at Abra questioningly. Abra looked through her. She went to Aga, then Ovra. No one saw her. When she approached, they turned away or moved aside. Not deliberately to let her pass, but as though they had planned to move away before she came. She ran to Olga.
It's me! It's Ayla! I'm standing right here! Don't you see me?
She motioned. Olga's eyes glazed over. She turned around and walked away, making no response, no sign of recognition, as though Ayla were invisible. Ayla saw Kreb walking toward Issa. She ran to him.
Kreb, it's Ayla! I'm here!
She gestured frantically. The old magician kept walking, barely turning aside to avoid the girl who crumpled at his feet, as he would an inanimate boulder in his path.
Kreb! She wailed. Why can't you see me?
She got up and ran back to Issa.
Mother! Mother! Look at me! Look at me!
She gesticulated in front of the woman's eyes. Issa began a high-pitched wail again. She flailed her arms and pounded her chest.
My child, my Ayla, my daughter is dead. She is gone, my poor, poor Ayla. She lives no more.
Ayla spied Uba hugging her mother's legs in fear and confusion. She knelt down in front of the little girl.
You see me, don't you, Uba? I'm right here.
Ayla saw recognition register in the child's eyes. But the next moment, Abra swooped down and carried the little girl away.
I want Ayla,
Uba motioned, struggling to get down. Ayla is dead, Uba. She's gone. That's not Ayla. It's only her spirit. It must find its way to the next world. If you try to talk to it, if you see it, the spirit will try to take you with it. It will bring you bad luck if you see it. Don't look at it. You don't want bad luck, do you, Uba? Ayla slumped to the ground. She hadn't really known what a death curse meant and had imagined all kinds of horrors. But the reality was far worse. Ayla had ceased to exist for the clan. It was no sham, no act put on to frighten her. She did not exist. She was a spirit who happened to be visible, who still gave a semblance of life to her body. But Ayla was dead. Death was a change of state to the people of the clan, a journey to another plane of existence. The life force was an invisible spirit. It was obvious. A person could be alive one moment and dead the next, with no apparent change, except that that which caused movement and breath and life was gone. The essence that was the real Ayla was no longer a part of their world. It had been forced to move on to the next. It mattered not at all if the physical part that remained behind was cold and unmoving or warm and animated. It was only another step to believe the essence of life could be driven away. If her physical body didn't know it yet, it would soon enough. No one really believed she would ever return, not even Brunn. Her body, the empty shell, could never remain viable until her spirit was allowed to return. Without the life spirit, the body couldn't eat,
couldn't drink and would soon deteriorate. If such a concept was firmly believed, and if loved ones no longer acknowledged existence, there was no existence, no reason to eat or drink or live. But as long as the spirit stayed near the cave, animating the body, though no longer a part of it, the forces that drove it away hovered nearby, too. They might harm those still living, might try to take another life with them. It was not unknown for the mate or another close loved one of someone who had been cursed to die soon afterward themselves. The clan didn't care if the spirit took the body with it or left the unmoving shell behind, but they wanted the spirit of Ayla to go, and go quickly. Ayla watched the familiar people around her. They moved away, began doing routine tasks, but there was a strain. Kreb and Issa went into the cave. Ayla got up and followed. No one tried to stop her. Only Uba was kept away. Children were thought to have extra protection, but no one wanted to push it too far. Issa gathered all of Ayla's belongings, including her sleeping furs and the stuffing of dried grass that lined the scooped-out hollow in the ground, and carried them outside the cave. Kreb went with her, stopping to get a burning brand from the cave fire. The woman dumped everything beside an unlit fireplace Ayla hadn't noticed before, and hurried back into the cave while Kreb started a fire. He made silent gestures over her things and the fire, most of them unfamiliar to the girl. With growing dismay, Ayla watched Kreb start to feed each of her things to the hot flames. There would be no burial ceremony for her. That was part of the punishment, part of the curse. But all traces of her had to be destroyed. There must be nothing left that might hold her back. She watched her digging stick catch fire, then her collecting basket. The padding of dried grass, clothing, everything went into the fire. She saw Kreb's hand tremble as he reached for her fur wrap. He clutched it to his breast for a moment, then threw it on the fire. Ayla's eyes overflowed.
"Kreb, I love you," she gestured.
He didn't seem to see. With a sinking feeling of horror, she watched him pick up her medicine bag, the one Issa had made for her just before the ill-fated mammoth hunt, and add it to the smoking flames.
"No, Kreb! No! Not my medicine bag!" she pleaded.
It was too late. It was already burning. Ayla could stand no more. She tore blindly down the slope and into the forest, sobbing her heartache and desolation. She didn't see where she was going, and she didn't care. Branches reached out to block her way, but she plowed through them, tearing gashes in her arms and legs. She splashed through icy cold water, but didn't notice her soaked feet or feel them getting numb until she stumbled over a log and sprawled on the ground. She lay on the cold, damp earth, wishing death would hurry and relieve her of her misery. She had nothing. No family, no clan, no reason to live. She was dead. They said she was dead. The girl was close to having her wish granted. Lost in her private world of misery and fear, she hadn't eaten or drunk since her return more than 2 days before. She wore no warm clothing. Her feet ached with cold. She was weak and dehydrated, an easy target for a quick death from exposure. But there was something inside her stronger than her death wish. The same thing that had kept her going before, when a devastating earthquake left the 5-year-old girl bereft of love and family and security. An indomitable will to live, a stubborn survival instinct, would not let her quit while she still drew breath, still had life to go on. The stop had rested her. Bleeding from scratches and shivering with cold, she sat up. Her face had landed on damp leaves, and she licked her lips, her tongue reaching for the moisture. She was thirsty. She couldn't remember ever being so thirsty in her life. The gurgle of water nearby brought her to her feet. After a long, satisfying drink of cold water, she pushed on. She was shivering so hard her teeth chattered, and it hurt to walk on her cold, aching feet. She was lightheaded and disconcerted. Her activity warmed her a little, but her lowered body temperature was having its effects. She didn't know for sure where she was. She had no destination in mind, but her feet followed a route traveled many times before, etched in her brain by repetition. Time had no meaning for her.
She didn't know how long she had been walking. She climbed up along the base of a steep wall, beyond a misty waterfall, and became conscious of a familiar feeling to the area. Walking out of a sparse coniferous forest, intermixed with dwarfed birch and willow, she found herself at her high, secluded meadow. She wondered how long it had been since she visited the place. She had seldom gone there after she started hunting, except for the time she taught herself the double stone technique. It had always been a place for practicing, not hunting. Had she been there at all that summer? She couldn't recall. Pushing aside the thick, tangled branches that hid it even without foliage, Ayla went into her small cave. It seemed smaller than she remembered. "There's the old sleeping fir," she said to herself, thinking back to the time she had brought it up so long before. Some ground squirrels had made a nest in it, but when she took it outside and shook it out, she saw it was not too badly damaged, a little stiff with age, but the dry cave had preserved it. She wrapped it around herself, grateful for its warmth, and went back into the cave. There was a leather hide, an old cloak she had brought to the cave to stuff grass under for a pad. "I wonder if that knife is still here," she thought. "The shelf is down, but it ought to be somewhere near it. There it is!" Ayla picked the flint blade out of the dirt, brushed it off, and began to cut up the old leather cloak. She removed her wet foot coverings and threaded the thongs through holes cut into the circle she had cut, then wrapped her feet with dry ones, stuffing them with insulating sedge grass from under the cloak. She spread the wet ones out to dry and began to take stock. "I need a fire," she thought. "The dry grass will make good tinder." She shoved it together and piled it next to a wall. "The shelf is dry. I can shave it for kindling, and use it as a base to start a fire, too. I need a stick to twirl against it. There's my birch bark drinking cup. I could use that for a fire, too. No, I'll save it for water." "This basket is all chewed up," she thought, looking inside. "What's this?" "My old sling. I didn't know I left it here. I guess I just made another one." She held the sling up. "It's too small, and the mice got to it. I'll need a new one." She stopped and stared at the strip of leather in her hands. "I was cursed. Because of this, I was cursed. I'm dead. How can I be thinking about fires and slings? I'm dead. But I don't feel dead. I feel cold and hungry. Can a dead person feel cold and hungry? What does dead feel like? Is my spirit in the next world? I don't even know what my spirit is. I've never seen a spirit. Kreb says no one can see spirits, but he can talk to them. Why couldn't Kreb see me? Why couldn't anyone see me? I must be dead. Then why am I thinking about fires and slings? Because I'm hungry. Should I use a sling to get something to eat? Why not? I've already been cursed. What more can they do to me? But this one's no good. What can I use to make a new one? The cloak? No, it's too stiff. It's been out here too long. I need soft, pliable leather." She looked around the cave. "I can't even kill anything to make a sling if I don't have one. Where can I find soft leather?" She racked her brain, then sat down in despair. She looked down at her hands in her lap, then suddenly noticed what her hands were resting on. "My wrap! My wrap is soft and pliable. I can cut a piece out of it." She brightened and started looking around the cave with enthusiasm again. "Here's an old digging stick. I don't remember leaving one here. And some dishes. That's right, I did bring some shells up. I am hungry. I wish there was something to eat around here. Wait, there is. I didn't collect the nuts this year. They should be all over the ground outside." She hadn't realized it yet, but Ayla had begun to live again. She gathered the nuts, brought them into the cave, and ate as many as her stomach, shrunken from lack of food, could hold. Then she took off the old fur and her wrap and cut a piece from it for a sling. The strip didn't have the bulging pocket to hold the stones, but she thought it would work. She had never hunted animals for food before, and the rabbit was quick, but not quick enough. She thought she remembered passing a beaver dam. She got the aquatic animal just as it was diving for the water. On her way back, she saw a small, gray, chalky boulder near the creek. That's Flint. I know that's Flint. She picked up the nodule and hauled it back with her, too. She took the rabbit and beaver inside the cave and went back out to gather wood and find a hammer stone. I need a fire stick, she thought. It should be good and dry. This wood is a little damp. She noticed her old digging stick. That should work, she said to herself. It was a little difficult to start a fire by herself. She was used to alternating the downward-pressured twirling motion with another woman to keep it spinning. After intense effort and concentration, a smoldering chunk of the fire platform slipped onto the bed of dry tinder. She blew at it carefully and was rewarded with small, licking flames. She added the dry kindling, piece by piece, then larger pieces of the old shelf. When the fire was firmly established, she laid on the larger chunks of wood she had collected, and a cheerful fire warmed the small cave. I'm going to have to make a cooking pot, she thought as she spitted the skinned rabbit and laid the beaver tail on top to add its fatty richness to the lean meat. I'm going to need a new digging stick and a collecting basket. Kreb burned my collecting basket. He burned everything, even my medicine bag. Why did he have to burn my medicine bag? Tears began to well up and soon spilled down her cheeks. Issa said I was dead. I begged her to look at me, but she just said I was dead. Why couldn't she see me? I was standing right there, right in front of her. The girl cried for a while, then sat up straight and wiped away her tears. If I'm going to make a new digging stick, I'll need a hand axe, she said to herself firmly. While the rabbit was cooking, she nabbed herself a hand axe the way she had learned by watching Droog, and with it chopped down a green branch to make a digging stick. Then she gathered more wood and stacked it inside the cave. She could hardly wait for the meat to cook. The smell made her mouth water and her empty stomach growl. She was sure nothing had ever tasted so good when she took her first bite. It was dark by the time she was through, and Ayla was glad for the fire. She banked it to be sure it wouldn't die before morning, and lay down wrapped in the old fur, but sleep eluded her. She stared at the flames while the dismal events of the day marched through her mind in woeful procession, not realizing when tears started to flow. She was afraid, but more, she was lonely. She hadn't spent a night alone since Issa found her. Finally, exhaustion closed her eyes, but her sleep was disturbed by bad dreams. She called out for Issa, and she called out for another woman in a language all but forgotten. But there was no one to comfort the desperately, achingly, lonely girl. Ayla's days were busy, filled with activity to ensure her survival. She was no longer the inexperienced, unknowledgeable child she was at 5. During the years with the clan, she had had to work hard, but she had learned in the process. She wove tight, waterproof baskets to carry water and for cooking, and made herself a new collecting basket. She cured the skins of animals she hunted and made rabbit fur linings for the insides of her foot coverings, leggings wrapped and tied with cord, and hand coverings made in the style of foot coverings, circular pieces that tied at the wrist in a pouch but with slits cut in the palms for thumbs. She made tools from flint and collected grass to make her bed softer. The meadow grasses supplied food, too. They were top-heavy with seeds and grains. In the immediate vicinity were also nuts, high-bush cranberries, bearberries, hard small apples, starchy potato-like roots, and edible ferns. She was pleased to find milk vetch, the non-poisonous variety of the plant whose green pods held rows of small round legumes, and she even collected the tiny hard seeds from dried pigweed to grind and add to grains that she cooked into mush. Her environment supplied her needs. She decided shortly after she arrived that she needed a new fur wrap. Winter held back the worst of its weather, but it was cold, and she knew the snow would not be long in coming. She thought first of a lynx fur. The lynx held a special meaning for her, but its meat would be inedible, at least to her taste, and food was as important to her as fur. She had little trouble taking care of her immediate needs as long as she was able to hunt. But she needed to lay in a store for the time ahead when snow would keep her in the cave. Food was now her reason for hunting. She hated the thought of killing one of the gentle, shy creatures that had shared her retreat for so long, and she wasn't sure if a deer could be killed with a sling. She was surprised they still used the high pasture when she saw the small herd, but decided she had to take advantage of the opportunity before they moved to lower elevations. A stone hurled with force at close range felled a doe, and a hard blow with a wooden club finished it off. The fur was thick and soft. Nature had prepared the animal for the cold winter, and venison stew made a welcome supper. When the smell of fresh meat brought a bad-tempered wolverine, a swift stone killed it and reminded her the first animal she ever killed was a wolverine who had been stealing from the clan. Wolverines were good for something, she had told Oga. Frost from breathing did not build up on the fur of a wolverine. Their pelts always made the best hoods. This time I will make a hood from his pelt, she thought, dragging the slain scavenger back to the cave. She built fires in a circle around her lines of drying meat to keep other carnivores away and to hasten the process of drying, and she rather liked the taste the smoke gave to the meat. She dug a hole in the rear of her cave, shallow, since the layer of earth was not deep at the back of the small crack in the mountain, and lined it with stones from the stream. After her meat was stored, she covered her cache with heavy rocks. Her new fur, cured while the meat was drying, had a smoky odor, too. But it was warm, and with the old one, made her bed comfortable. The deer provided a water bag, too, from its well-washed, waterproof stomach, and sinew for cord, and fat from the lump above its tail where the animal stored its winter supply. She worried about snow every day while her meat was drying, and slept outside within her circle of fires to keep them fed during the night. She felt relieved and much more secure once it was safely stashed away. When a heavily overcast sky hid the moon, she became concerned about the passage of time. She remembered exactly what Brunn had said. If, by the grace of the spirits, you are able to return from the other world after the moon has gone through its cycle once and is in the same phase as now, you may live with us again. She didn't know if she was in the other world, but more than anything, she wanted to go back. She wasn't really sure if she could, didn't know if they would see her if she went back, but Brunn said she could, and she clung to the leader's words. Only how would she know when she could return if the clouds covered the moon? She remembered a time long before when Kreb showed her how to make notches on a stick. She guessed that the collection of notched sticks he kept in a part of the hearth, off-limits for the other members of his household, were tallies of the times between significant events. Once, out of curiosity, she decided to keep track of something like he did. And since the moon moved through repetitive cycles, she decided it would be fun to see how many notches it would take to complete one cycle. When Kreb found out, he scolded her severely. The reprimand reinforced her memory of the occasion, as well as warning her not to do it again. She worried a whole day how she would ever know when she could return to the cave before she remembered that time and decided to notch a stick every night. No matter how she tried to control them, tears came to her eyes every time she made a mark. Tears came to her eyes often. Small things triggered memories of love and warmth. A startled rabbit bounding across her path reminded her of long, shambling walks with Kreb. She loved his craggy, one-eyed, scarred old face. The thought of it filled her eyes to overflowing. Seeing a plant she had gathered for Issa, Ayla would burst into sobs, remembering the woman explaining how it was used, and a freshet of new tears came when she recalled Kreb burning her medicine bag. Nights were the worst. She was accustomed to being alone during the day from her years of roaming the countryside gathering plants or hunting, but she had never been away from people at night. Sitting alone in her small cave, staring at the fire and its glowing reflection dancing against the wall, she cried for the companionship of those she loved. In some ways, she missed Uba most of all. Often she hugged her fur to her chest and rocked back and forth, humming softly under her breath as she had done so often with Uba. Her environment supplied her physical needs, but not her human needs. The first snow sifted down silently during the night. Ayla exclaimed with delight when she stepped out of her cave in the morning. The pristine whiteness softened the contours of the familiar landscape, creating a magical dreamland of fantastic shapes and mythical plants. Bushes had top hats of soft snow. Conifers were dressed in new gowns of white finery, and bare exposed limbs were clothed in shining coats that outlined each twig against the deep blue sky. Ayla looked at her footprints, marring the perfect smooth layer of glistening white, then ran across the snowy blanket, crossing and recrossing her own path to make a complex design whose original intent was lost in the execution. She started to follow the tracks of a small animal, then spontaneously changed her mind and climbed out on the narrow ledge of the rocky outcrop swept clean of snow by the wind. The entire mountain range, marching up behind her in a series of majestic peaks, was covered with white, shadowed in blue. It sparkled in the sun like a gigantic, luminous jewel. The vista spread out before her showed the lowest reaches of the snowfall. The blue-green sea, whipped to a frothy foam of waves, nestled between the cleft of snow-covered hills, but the steps to the east were still bare. Ayla saw tiny figures scuttling across the white expanse directly below her. It had snowed at the cave of the clan, too. One of the figures seemed to shuffle with a slow limp. Suddenly, the magic left the snowy landscape, and she climbed back down. The second snowfall had no magic at all. The temperature dropped sharply. Whenever she left the cave, fierce winds drove sharp needles into her bare face, leaving it raw. The blizzard lasted 4 days, piling snow so high against the wall it nearly blocked the entrance to her cave. She tunneled out, using her hands and a flat hip bone of the deer she had killed, and spent the day gathering wood. Drying the meat had depleted the supply of fallen wood nearby, and floundering through deep snow left her exhausted. She was sure she had food enough to last her, but she hadn't been as careful about stockpiling wood. She wasn't sure she had enough, and if it snowed much more, her cave would be buried so deep she wouldn't be able to get out. For the first time since she found herself at her small cave, she feared for her life. The elevation of her meadow was too high. If she got trapped in her cave, she'd never last through the winter. She hadn't had time to prepare for the entire cold season. Ayla returned to her cave in the afternoon and promised herself to get more wood the next day. By morning, another blizzard was howling with full force, and the entrance to her cave was completely blocked. She felt closed in, trapped, and frightened. She wondered how deeply she was buried under the snow. She found a long branch and poked it up through the branches of the hazelnut bush, knocking snow into her cave. She felt a draft and looked up to see snow flying horizontally in the driving wind. She left the branch in the hole and went back to her fire. It was fortunate she had decided to measure the height of the drift. The hole, kept open by the stick, brought fresh air into the tiny space she occupied. The fire needed oxygen, and so did she. Without the air hole, she could easily doze into a sleep from which she'd never wake up. She had been in more danger than she knew. She found she didn't need much of a fire to keep the cave warm. The snow, trapping minuscule air pockets between its frozen crystals, was a good insulator. Her body heat alone could almost have kept the small space warm. But she needed water. The fire was more important to melt snow than to maintain heat. Alone in the cave, lit only by the small fire, the only way she could tell the difference between day and night was by the dim light that filtered in through the air hole during the daytime. She was careful to mark a notch on her stick each evening when the light faded. With nothing much to do except think, she stared long at the fire. It was warm, and it moved, and, enclosed in her tomb-like world, it began to take on a life of its own. She watched it devour each stick of wood, leaving only a residue of ash. Does fire have a spirit, too? She wondered. Where does the fire spirit go when it dies? Kreb says when a person dies, the spirit goes to the next world. Am I in the next world? Doesn't feel any different. Lonelier, that's all. Maybe my spirit is someplace else. How do I know? I don't feel like it, though. Well, maybe. I think my spirit is with Kreb and Issa and Uba. But I'm cursed. I must be dead. Why would my totem give me a sign, knowing I'd be cursed? Why would I think he gave me a sign if he didn't? I thought he tested me. Maybe this is another test. Or has he deserted me? But why would he choose me and then desert me? Maybe he didn't desert me. Maybe he went to the spirit world for me. Maybe he's the one who's fighting the evil spirits. He could do it better than I could. Maybe he sent me here to wait. Could it be?